Now, let's go back to January 4th, 1943.
Well, sir, it's early evening as we enter the small house halfway up in the next block now. And here in the living room, we find Mr. and Mrs. Victor Gook. Vic is seated in his easy chair reading some sort of brochure, while Sade, on the davenport, languidly scans the newspaper. And at length...
Is that another large catalog?
It's the thing that come in the yellow envelope the mailman left this afternoon.
Is it another large catalog?
Yes, after a manner of speaking.
Trying to sell you more junk, are they?
You speak with unwonted hushness, Dr. Speech.
Well, by golly, they'll gobble up a person's last nickel if you give them half a chance.
We still got a couple of nickels in reserve.
What they got for sale this trip?
A sort of intangible commodity. Lodge headquarters, through some source or another, have acquired the right to...
Oh, that's Ruthie, calling about 500.
Thought you girls had a definite date.
No, we left it up in the air. She had to wait and see how Fred felt this evening. Been kind of halfway off his feed.
Oh.
Hello? Yes, lady? Oh, finished supper half an hour ago. Got my dishes done besides. Uh-huh. Why, I bet we'd love to. No, I don't even have to ask the big muckety-muck. You scalawags come right on ahead. Oh, now listen. No, but he's forever doing that. Well, if he insists on being stubborn. All right. That crazy Fred says he's going to bring over ice cream or know the reason why.
Crazy's right.
What flavor you want?
Caramel.
Chocolate?
Caramel.
Vic is running around the room on one foot screaming and yelling for chocolate, Ruthie. Yes. Well, fine. Chocolate, then, if chocolate's agreeable with Fred. Yes, I guess I remember Fred's fond of chocolate flavor. All righty, Ruthie. You betty, lady. Goodbye.
Caramel.
Put your shoes on.
They're under my chair here. I'll grab them when sweet old lovable Fred arrives.
Now, don't you be short and sarcastic with Fred tonight. He's not quite up to snuff these last couple days. Ruthie said he... sneezed 3 or 4 times in succession at the dinner table this noon.
How horrible.
Well, you just remember to be pleasant.
I will hold Fred to my breast and protect him from every wind that blows.
Not a single darn thing in the newspaper. Except for the little daily love story. It's just so much piffle.
Did you read the front page?
Nah.
There are 1 or 2 items of interest to be found there.
What's the lodge trying to sell you this trip?
Honorary titles.
Oh?
Headquarters has somehow acquired possession of quite a list of them. And they're cheap. I may invest in a few.
What kind of titles?
Well, here we have member of the board of directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad.
I don't understand.
Well, it's simple enough.
You'd be that?
For a fee, sure. Let's see, what is the fee? 35 cents.
You pay 35 cents?
Uh-huh.
And what do you get for it?
The privilege of calling myself by this title.
Well, why would you want to do that?
Oh, it'd be nice to adorn my business card. Could be an asset in many ways. Suppose I wanted to impress somebody. I could tell them that, aside from being the head of the bookkeeping department at Plant 14 of the Consolidated Kitchenware Company, I also had the honor of being a member of the board of directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad.
Is there such a railroad?
Sure.
And for 35 cents paid into the lodge, you'd actually be on the board of directors?
Well, in a purely nominal way. I wouldn't, of course, go and attempt to establish myself as an executive. My power in the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad would be definitely limited.
Would you have any power at all?
Well, no.
Well, what a dandy red-hot way to spend 35 cents.
It's the impressiveness of it, Sadie. The glamour, if you will. You know what pride you take in being president of the Thimble Club.
But I am president of the Thimble Club.
So am I, a member of the board of directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad, if I pay my 35 cents.
Oh, if.
I know it sounds a little fakey and feeble on the face of it, but in modern business and progressive civilization, there are wheels within wheels.
I'll say.
Well, I can see how my having a little like a title like that might rebound to your gratification.
Uh-huh.
Suppose you ladies are at somebody's house having a bang-up Thimble Club meeting, and Ma Epperot gets to bragging about her uncle or her nephew or somebody. As slick as grease and as poisonous as an adder, you can softly say, "How nice for him. Did I ever tell you Mr. Gook is a member
of the Board of Directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad.
I can see myself.
It's just possible. It's just possible.
Here's a son of a gun of a title.
Hmm?
Ex-monarch of Prashunya and Bascadrille, Gulliver Island Group, Caribbean Sea.
King of something?
Ex-king of something.
Oh, now that's the limit.
It is a trifle extreme, yeah. If you had that on your calling card and got to showing it to people, there might be doubts and skepticism.
Yes.
Here's one with more reason to it. Lifetime honorary president of the Tom Bashaw Fine Arts College for Young Women, Dismal Seepage, Ohio.
Ah, college president. It'd look nice on your calling card.
$1.20.
Oh, worth every penny.
Here's a long baby. Member of the High Board of Executive Regents, inactive pro tempore, two crosses, a plume, and a garter without portfolio for collisionary interstate trusteeships between Maine and Nebraska, Kentucky and Minnesota, Indiana and Texas, without recourse to recall and unconditionally vetoed notwithstanding.
That's all one title?
Uh-huh.
How much? $900?
10 cents.
My stars.
Too wordy.
Yeah.
And for 6 bits, you can call yourself captain and manager of the Sick Valley Hotshot Girls Softball Team, all-time free throw champions of the Slag Mountain League, Lower Swilly, Tennessee.
Oh.
And for $1.15...
Who can that be now?
Bluetooth Johnson.
Bluetooth is with Rush down at the YMCA.
Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan.
Yeah, I suppose. Hello? Oh, yes, lady. Oh, got slowed up, huh? Well, goodness, we're not impatient. Take your time. No, just sitting here talking. You're just this minute leaving the house? Well, dandy, but don't hurry yourself and get all out of breath. Just take your time. Sure. What? All right. Fred hollering again.
Karma.
You run childishness into the ground.
I'm always a poor half.
Oh? Why, we decided on chocolate flavor, didn't we? I'm pretty sure we decided on chocolate flavor. Just a second. That absent-minded scalawag of a Fred went to work and forgot what flavor ice cream we decided on.
Caramel.
Chocolate, wasn't it?
Caramel.
Yes, chocolate, Ruthie. You bet. Well, we'll be here, so don't feel you have to run or anything. All righty, Ruthie. Goodbye. Caramel.
Hey, there's a chap in Yellow Jump, North Dakota, that bought himself a dozen titles. Set him back 50 smacks. Listen to all the stuff he's got on his calling card. Edward King, 712 West Wood Street, Grape Hunch, Alabama. And here are the titles. Keeper, controller, warden, and manager of the Ohio State Home for Bald-Headed People.
Good.
Oh, that's only one. Supreme vested authority of the drowsier Minnesota Coal, Coke, and Lumber Company. Co-captain, left tackle, coach, and chief rubber of the Lame Apollo football team, Cheyenne, Kansas. Member of the board of directors of the West Virginia, Charleston, and Rapid Shuttle System. Member of the board of directors of the Overhead Cantilever Bridge, Bass, and Bluen Building. Surgeon-in-chief of the Slusher Junction, Arkansas Bicycle Works. Indefatigable prime potentate.
That's all on one calling card.
Huh?
All that mess is on one little calling card.
Sure, and there's a half dozen more titles I haven't read.
What's the fella do?
How you mean?
What's the fella actually do in real life?
Oh, let's see. He tells her someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here we are. Edward King, holder of this impressive list of titles, carries a newspaper route as his regular business.
Oh, my.
He, of course, has gone a little too far with his titles. They won't wash. They're not plausible.
No, they're not.
And some of them are kind of appealing. I wouldn't mind having that railroad one, for instance. Victor R. Gook, member of the board of directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad.
Mm.
Only cost 35 cents. And I rather fancy this one here about...
Dolphin's ringing.
Most likely Smelly Clark.
Uh-huh.
No, but about these titles. For a dollar or so, a
hello?
Fella could...
Well, lady, what a hunter... Oh, you're at the drugstore. Well, I wondered. Oh? Oh, uh-huh. I see. Well, just a second. The drugstore's all out of chocolate flavor ice cream.
Caramel.
Strawberry?
Caramel.
I think Fred likes strawberry better than caramel.
Caramel?
He likes Tutti Frutti better than caramel, too. Shall I tell him to get Tutti Frutti?
Caramel.
Caramel, I guess, lady. Caramel.
Despite the sometimes outrageous things they did, the characters on Vic and Sade seemed so real that we might wonder whether the actors themselves became the characters they played, at least to some extent.
Not that I know. It's possible, but I usually know when I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. But I don't just absentmindedly do it, no. I don't think I do I, Bill? I don't remember ever doing that. But if I know I'm talking to a fan of Vic and Sade, then I may.
I'll say yes and no. Yes, in this way, that it the association with Paul in his writings changed my conversation. I found I was a little more flip in those days and facetious, and was constantly using some of the little sayings from the show, like fine, or he's a good boy, or you'll enjoy that. It came out in conversation more than anything. It took a while for it to go away. Because people today wouldn't understand that.
Well, I think toward the end, after they had gotten so deeply into the characters and had become so at home with each other and had become so capable of interpreting what Reimer wanted to have them interpret, I think they had a devil of a time getting back into their own personalities, because I know Byrne, who had been a very chic, sleek, coiffed, the latest couture, suddenly became a nice, matronly sort of a person. She married in the meanwhile, but she suddenly became a Sade. And Vic became even more waspish as the time went on. And Rush became even more, in a sense, challenging to Vic, to make Vic, because Rush loved to provoke Vic in the scripts. He would say things and Vic would blow up, you know. And the same thing with Uncle Fletcher. The Rush and Uncle Fletcher understood each other, and the two of them would needle Vic. And they grew to the point where I think they were living these lives. And I think it was wonderful, because so few shows offer any inducement to become a part of them. Everybody was heart deep, knee deep, hip deep, emotion deep in that show. And Paul did nothing to foster this. It's what Paul wrote that fostered this.
But he had such a sense of rhythm. Everything went in threes, which makes for rhythm, of course. When you read the scripts, and if you look for that, you'll see it. It's kind of like music. Banal as the words may be, ordinary as the conversation may be, it's woven beautifully into a tapestry of rhythm. And you can't break it. But we didn't start out that way. He used our idiosyncrasies to build on. And we recognize ourselves sometimes and laugh. I came down one day wearing a pair of glasses, and I was at great pains to tell him it wasn't my eyes. It was these headaches I had, and the doctor thought that if I wore glasses, I wouldn't have these headaches. But my eyes, I can see anything. I can read anything. I don't need them to see with. Well, Paul Reimer wrote a script about Sadie and the glasses, and I felt like a fool because here, which I was, it was Sadie, obstinately proclaiming that the doctor ordered glasses for her, but she didn't need them to see with.
But the whole family enhanced what Paul wrote, and Paul could write for the family. He had this wonderful feeling for people in his writing, and certainly for the people that read his lines. Because we would break up in the studio. There's many a time when the curtain went down and the last line had been read, such as these episodes when Vic got into his lodge clothing and he trips over a sword and he falls into a washpan full of clothes that Byrne had put on the kitchen table, and everything is crashing around, and it was a sound effects man delight. We'd break up in the control room to the point that when I had to come up and read the closing Crisco commercial, it was all I could do to keep a straight face, and some of the times I just broke up in the middle of the commercial. Of course, Bill Ramsey loved this. He didn't mind this at all. It was great. Thankfully, we had a client that didn't. But it was a show where there was a wonderful, close-knit quality between Paul and Byrne and Vic and Billy. And if I may say so, Clint Stanley, who was the producer and of whom Paul always wrote in the show about Third Lieutenant Stanley up the Amazon, and myself. And one of the reasons I think that Vic and Sade was great was certainly Paul, certainly the cast, certainly the what little production that had to go into it, because the cast intuitively knew how to read Paul's lines. But I think it was the fact that in the midst of a welter of tears that began like at 9 o'clock in the morning with John's other wife and ended at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with some other bathos type of thing that went on the air in those days, Vic and Sade, with its little warm daily vignettes with no cliffhanger to worry about for the next day, each episode stopped right in the middle. Vic and Sade was a sort of an island of sheer delight in a sea of tears. And I think that's another reason it was a great success.
But, see, Paul, it was in his writing. He even underlined words. And occasionally we would get a green director, some new man, and they thought some of the NBC executives had the mistaken notion that the play would run itself, the series. Like some directors feel that a play, once it's established in New York, can be sent on the road and it'll just go on and on. They fall apart. Director has to be there, and a director has to know his show. Well, sometimes we were handed over to a new director. No fault of that man. It wasn't a lack of ability, but in this particular field, he was unaccustomed to it. And I remember one we had, and it had to do with lines like this, that Paul would underline certain words. For instance, Sade and Vic, maybe Rush, would be sitting on the front porch. And they lacked anything momentous to tell each other. That happens to all of us. So they'd say, "Oh, there goes old Mr. Johnson. He's got his little hamburger." Or, "There goes old Mrs. Fuddlefingers. She's got her little bag."
Well, I guess I have to admit I belong to a pretty red-blooded, active set of fellas. My arteries pump away with energy.
There's Mr. Kreider.
Uh-huh.
Got his little quarter's worth of steak from Croucher's Meat Market.
How do you know?
He gets a little quarter's worth of steak every evening. Cooks it himself and eats it himself.
Pay him to buy it in the bulk. The other day I saw Eugene in Tapman's vacant lot.
That was Mr. Clark.
Uh-huh.
Got his little umbrella up.
Wonder why. The rain stopped.
He carries it to keep off the sun. He had sunstroke one time and's been scared of it ever since.
Yeah?
He always wears tennis shoes on account of that, too.
Because he got sunstroke?
Mm-hmm. When he was a young man working on a farm, he keeled over from the heat. Affected his ankle some way. Had to wear tennis shoes ever since to be comfortable.
Funny place to get sunstroke, an ankle.
Yeah, but that's the way it is.
Pretty nice sitting here in the porch swing, huh?
Lovely day, all right.
Ain't you glad I called you out?
Miss Simmons turning off on Kelsey.
Uh-huh.
She's got her little girl.
And so the director said, "This Mr. Johnson has his little package of hamburger. Mr. Johnson doesn't have his little package of hamburger." He said, "This is the way the author underlined it, and there's a reason for that. It has to do with rhythm, with what touches off a spark in people, makes them respond to it. That's the humor. That's why Mr. Thurber said it's beautiful to one line that somebody else couldn't understand." And so we honored his underscorings. And we also honored, he did a thing that is rather rare, interrupted conversation. It rarely did anybody finish a sentence any more than they do in a family sitting around talking. But you had to interrupt where Paul Reimer indicated, or you broke the rhythm.
Michigan Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan, finally married Jane Bain from Payne, Maine.
later died.
Two names that don't appear, or at least I haven't heard them in discussions of Ickenside, were Mr. Kidney Saddle and Mr. Chestbutter. I can't remember what Chestbutter and Kidney Saddle did, but I think this has almost the quality of Dickens. They're wonderful names. You can Chestbutter, Kidney Saddle, Beef Punkles. Paul had a way with words. The words were ridiculous, but they had a sonority. They had a beautiful rolling quality.
Yeah, and Paul, with his great perception and his great genius, you know, he made those characters, made us, a combination of the characters from his own childhood, his own father and mother and himself, and he combined that with what we were as people. Somehow he amalgamated those two things so that those characters became very organic for the three of us. He knew our own feelings about things and our own personality so well. He wrote for us, and yet he was writing about his own life. And it's funny, it's my feeling that he was Rush half the time, and he was Vic the other half the time, because he had his own son. And when Vic spoke, sometimes it was Paul talking to his kid, and sometimes he was Rush talking back to his old man and to his mother. So it was really strange, the things that happened, the wheels within wheels, as Paul used to say.
And never has a group of performers displayed so much sincere respect for one another.
We all did have tremendous respect for one another, and we all thought the other actors on the show were the funniest, most wonderful people we knew.
They were perfect. They grew with the show, and Paul wrote for each one.
This is not to say that there were not momentary conflicts and little bits of temperament and pique, and we would get sore, but down deep, you know, we all loved each other very much. And in order to work well together for 12 years, there had to be that feeling, you know. We were a real family.
And Paul Reimer was our best audience, by the way. And instead of saying, look, I want it this way, look, he said over and over again, I thought this script was a bunch of nothing till I heard you people do it. He gave us full credit when we really didn't deserve it.
We had fun in radio in those days, though. I just wonder if they have as much fun in television today.
Mary Fran told me one time that she had to be someplace, and Paul did his writing at home. So in a period of walking around and thinking about things, he strolled out to the kitchen, and Mary Fran had a helper, a maid helper, come in about once a week and clean things up, for whom she would leave notes telling her what to do, what she wanted, whether to wash windows in the living room and vacuum the dining room or whatever. And Paul went out in the kitchen, and he wrote these notes. Then he took off for the afternoon because he didn't want to be around when there was cleaning noise going on. And out he went. Mary Fran came in first, and she saw these notes. And they were something like this. Gloria, Mrs. Reimer wants you to move the kitchen stove over to the west wall this afternoon. And she would prefer to have the kitchen sink over nearer the refrigerator. And there's plenty, we've measured, and there's plenty of room for it. And he had this poor little maid, her job that afternoon was moving all the heavy kitchen equipment all over the place. And that's the kind of thing, he lived it. He was always a joy and a delight to be with.
Ickenside was unique in another way. The people that Jack Foster interviewed, professionals with many other important shows to their credit, felt without exception that being a part of Ickenside was the most important thing of their careers.
Oh, we enjoyed doing that. It was no work. That wasn't work. That was pleasure.
I don't know any program that I ever walked in the studio to announce and look forward to. like I did Vic and Sade.
I don't think there'll be anything that I can do to top what I did on Vic and Sade.
Oh, unquestionably. I think that was I know that was the thing that brought me the most satisfaction. I think the part of Uncle Fletcher was the best thing I ever did, and the most enjoyable thing, and the most rewarding thing that I have ever done, spiritually particularly.
Yes, it was the most important thing I did in my career as an actress. I felt and feel that it was very important. When the work you're doing generates a feeling of perpetuity, it really does. Beside that it can reach so many people, so many surprisingly different people. It is a very worthwhile thing.
Oh, I don't think there's anything that can come close to it. I've always enjoyed everything I've done, mostly, but this was an outstanding thing. I felt very honored that I got a chance to work in it, because it is a classic. It'll always remain a classic. Clarence Hartzell, of course, came in to Vic and Sade later, in the late 30s, I believe. He was fantastic playing Uncle Fletcher, and he was a funny man, and just great. Billy Idelson's a very fine actor and also a very fine writer, as you well know, and doing very well in California at the present time. There was not any funnier man than Art Van Harvey. His timing was so perfect. He was a great dialectician, which not very many people knew, and he did funny, funny stories. And Bernadine, who's a beautiful woman and still a beautiful woman and a fine actress, just great. But Paul Reimer... He used to just die laughing. He wrote the thing, and he would get it going. He'd come in the control room, and we'd be on the air, and he's falling off his chair laughing at the stuff that we're reading that he wrote.
You know,
just fall on the floor.
Such an artist. He got the very most out of every syllable, every word.
Well, Paul was something else. Paul was a man that I idolized. He's been my idol in life. In two ways, as a person and as a professional, as a writer, I learned a great deal from him. I think everything I know about comedy writing comes from Paul, and I also admired him tremendously as a man. I thought he was really one of the distinctive characters that I ever ran into in my whole life. And I, as a matter of fact, I named my first son Paul, after Paul Reimer.
But I see it as great writing, ranking among the writings of all American humorists, the best, living and dead.
And even while it was on, you know, everybody had a different viewpoint of the show. There were people that just saw it as a kind of a cute slice of life, you know, and that the people were kind of like the people that they knew, maybe a little dumber. And there were relatively few people that saw a commentary on a portion of American life and then saw it as a really brilliant satire, which it was.
Paul was a craftsman. He led you so nicely. He never left anything hanging. His words were, as I say, there were none wasted. And everyone painted a picture that was fantastic. If ever an epitaph is written on my gravestone when I pass on to the great radio station in the sky, I can think of nothing nicer on my gravestone than he used to be the announcer for Vic and Sade.
Which concludes another brief visit at the small town halfway up in the next state. Let's hope we can get together again sometime. Our thanks to Daryl McAllister of NBC, AFCO Broadcasting Corporation, and Miami University at Oxford, Ohio, for their contributions of special material, and to the State Historical Society of Wisconsin for the use of their archives. This tribute to Vic and Sade was produced by Jack Foster for distribution without charge to radio stations everywhere. This is Bob Arbogast speaking.
Arbogast? Wasn't Arbogast from out of St. Louis?
No, Uncle Fletcher, it was Dismal Seepage, Ohio.
Went into the powdered rabbit business, married a woman 27 years old, and later died.